Is your name Patrick Mahon?
It is.
How old are you?
34.
For 2 years until the date of your arrest, were you sales manager for a firm at Sunbury?
I was indeed.
Did your duties take you to an office in London?
They did.
Did you thus meet a typist who was employed there?
I did.
What was the typist's name?
Miss Kay, Miss Emily Kay.
The place is Lewes, county town of Sussex, and the setting for these questions is the old Assize Court, one of the smallest in England, also one of the most historic. The year is 1924. For politicians, the year of the first Labour government. For playgoers, the year of Noel Coward's first great success. For students of crime, the year of Patrick Mahon. Mahon now standing his trial upon a capital charge, now being taken through his story by his counsel. A story which he hopes will lead the jury to acquit him. Acquit him of the murder of Miss Emily Kay.
When did you make the acquaintance of Miss Kay?
Last summer, about a year ago.
Did you know where she was living?
Oh, yes, at a club, a woman's club in Guildford Street.
Bloomsbury, that's right.
Did you ever call at that club?
Yes.
To take Miss Kay out?
Yes.
A lady's man, Mahon. It's stamped all over him. You can see it even now when he's fighting for his life. The sexy smile, the curly hair, the coaxing bedroom eyes. Perfect suburban Don Juan. Perfect tennis club Lothario. All the cheap good looks, all the superficial charm. Girls went for Mahon, and Mahon went for girls.
You're a married man.
I am.
Did you ever say anything to Miss Kay about your being married?
Yes, I did, often.
What is your wife's occupation?
She was at the same firm as myself, a secretary. Not a secretary, the secretary.
Secretary of the firm?
Yes.
A responsible position?
Yes.
Was she known both at Sunbury and at this London office?
She was.
Known as Mrs. Mahon?
Yes.
Mahon had married when he was 20, when his bride was just 18. She had always been the most loyal wife. She had never failed him. It wasn't only that she'd passed up his numerous affairs. More difficult than that, she'd passed up his convictions. Convictions for offences committed after they were married. For embezzlement. For burglary. For doing grievous bodily harm. The jury, of course, this jury in Lewes, they know nothing of all that. They weren't allowed to know the normal protection English law gives to an accused. They don't know he did two stretches. Once he went down for 5 years. 5 years while Mrs. Mahon bravely bore the brunt. A woman of ability as well as character, she had fended for herself and for their little daughter. And when Mahon came out, it was she who got him the job with the firm at Sunbury. Got him the job, no questions asked, apparently, simply because they thought so much of her. It's fair to say that Mahon didn't let her down, not in this respect, at least. He impressed his bosses quite a lot, actually got promoted. As his affair with Emily Kay flourished and prospered, his business affairs, they flourished and prospered too. Not so Emily Kay's. In October 1923, through some staff reshuffle, she lost her job. Mahon's counsel raises this matter, puts it to him now. Did you know that Miss Kay's employment had been discontinued?
Yes.
Did you remain friends?
Yes.
Intimate?
Yes.
That word, intimate, in one sense, simply a communion of minds. In another sense, the old divorce court sense, a communion of bodies. It's going to be spelled out, the appropriate meaning here. Not yet. Later on. Was Miss Kay fond of you?
Very. She often expressed her love for me, her desire for me.
More than that, Mahon adds, he found himself being pressed to try a love experiment.
What was that?
She told me I was cold and didn't give her a chance. She suggested I should take a holiday with her. Her idea was that if we were alone together, she would convince me I'd be entirely happy with her. Were you willing to fall in with this idea?
I didn't want to.
Quite true, he didn't want to. Mahon was a womanizer, and as usual, he was womanizing. What an earlier generation would have called philandering. He found Emily Kay physically attractive, but he had no deep feelings, no lasting feelings for her. So he fought shy of any love experiment. He used delaying tactics, not complete rejection. Dragged his feet, as the saying goes. But in the end, Emily Kay prevailed. She got her way. She had a strong will, an exceptionally strong will, and several factors reinforced it, made it even stronger. She was in love with Mahon, passionately in love. She was rather older than he was. Doesn't matter 4 times out of 5, but women fear it does. And by March at latest, March of 1924, she knew she was pregnant. By him. There had been no other man. She, not he, cast about for a suitable love nest. She, not he, discovered a bungalow on the Crumbles, lonely stretch of beach between Pevensey and Eastbourne. Mahon yielded, took a short lease in a phony name. He told his wife he would be travelling on business, an excuse she was well accustomed to. Emily Kay went ahead by a day or so. Mahon joined her, slept with her there, on Saturday, 12th April. Before catching his train from London, he did some shopping. "Yes, I went to buy a shirt near Victoria Station. Almost opposite, I saw the Kitchen Equipment Company. Then I remembered the key of the bungalow."
"What about the key?"
"It was large, and I had in mind putting a Yale lock on instead."
"Did you get one?"
"Not at that time. I also had in mind, you see, getting some things for the table. We were short of a carving knife, and I bought a knife the assistant said was a chef's knife. It would do. I also bought a saw, useful for fixing the lock. They were just closing. The assistant was in a hurry, so I didn't bother about the lock itself. Thought I could get that easily in Eastbourne."
"Did you get it in Eastbourne?"
"Yes, I did, on the Monday, Mr. Castles."
J.D. Castles, representing Mahon, a leading criminal advocate, like Sir Henry Curtis Bennett for the Crown. Unlike in appearance, Castles lean and spare, Curtis Bennett plump and portly. Alike in mental powers, both of them shrewd and agile. Which shone most in the case, and they often were opposed, that would depend to some extent which side they were on, what they had to do. At the bar, it is less spectacular to construct than to destroy. Mahon and Emily Kay, Castles elicits this, they spent a long weekend together at the bungalow. Over the Saturday, the Sunday, and the Monday. Interrupted for a few hours on the Tuesday when they went up to London. Mahon, so he promised Miss Kay, for a specific purpose.
"What purpose?"
"To get a passport so that I could go to Paris with her."
"A passport for yourself only?"
"Miss Kay already had a passport."
Mahon's getting near the crucial part of his evidence. The decisive part. He's showing signs of strain.
"What happened on your London visit?"
"We split up for an hour."
"During that hour, what were you supposed to do?"
"Go to the passport office."
"Did you?"
No. When you met again, Castles asks, did Miss Kay say anything? She inquired if I had been there. And your reply? I told her yes at the station, then I told her the truth on the train. What followed? A quarrel. After she'd begged me to get a passport, and I had definitely refused. The quarrel, Mahon says, continued on and off during the journey and back at the bungalow. There he lit a fire, breaking up the coal with an axe, leaving the axe, carelessly, he says, on a table in the sitting room. Miss Kay, Mahon says, urged him to run away with her. Once more he refused, and that sparked off the climax. According to the sole survivor of the climax, Mahon. She got very angry and excited. Before I knew where I was, she flung the axe at me. Did it hit you? Glanced off my shoulder. She followed up, leapt across the room, clawing at my face. Mahon seems to break down, hides his face in his hands. The judge watches him with cool detachment, till he looks up again. We have got so far as she was clawing at your face. Mr. Justice Avery was never one to be influenced by emotion. With a countenance like parchment and a dry, cracked voice, he had acquired the nickname of the Hanging Judge. Yet Patrick Hastings, that outstanding counsel, wrote in his autobiography, "If I were guilty, Avery wasn't the judge I should have picked to try me. But if I were innocent, I should have felt glad my future was in his hands." However, back to Lewis. "We have got so far as she was clawing at your face," the judge repeats. "Yes, my lord." Mahon straightens, turns towards the bench. "Yes, my lord, I realized I was dealing with a woman almost mad with anger. I closed with her, and we struggled, backwards and forwards. I soon realized she was beginning to get the better of me." "You did you?" says the judge, expressionless. "Yes, my lord. Then I made a despairing effort, and we fell, both of us fell."
"You fell with her, did you?"
"Yes, my lord."
"Who was underneath?"
"Miss Kay, my lord."
"Were either of you injured in the fall?"
"Miss Kay's head hit the coal scuttle." The judge makes a careful note. Castles now resumes. "What about you, Mahon?"
"I lost consciousness. I fainted."
Hardly a sound in court. You can almost hear the scratch of Avery's pen. "When you came round," says Castles, "in what condition was Miss Kay?"
"On the floor, motionless. Blood had flowed from her head."
"What did you do?"
"Tried to revive her."
"How?"
"Pinched her, dashed water in her face, called her name, kept calling her name."
"With what effect?"
None. She never moved nor answered."
"Yes," says Castles, gently prompting. "I went out," says Mahon, "into the garden. I was crazy with fright."
"How long did you stay in the garden?"
Hours, almost till dawn."
"When you did go in again, where was Miss Kay?"
"Still there."
"Lying there?"
"Lying there."
"And dead?"
"And dead." I'm not going into details. I prefer to spare you that of how Mahan dismembered, what else he did to the dead woman. It's too horrible. So horrible that when Bernard Spilsbury examined the residual shambles in the bungalow, he said it was more gruesome than anything even he had ever seen. That, from a great pathologist with unique experience, constitutes a warning not to be ignored. About this aspect, then, I'll only report what's absolutely essential to keep the story in sequence and perspective. Mahan did the work, let's call it that, the work, over a number of days, over a number of nights. He used for the work the chef's knife and the saw that he'd bought on his way to the love experiment. When he thought the work complete, and Emily Kay beyond the reach of detective investigation or of scientific skill, he deposited the knife. It was identifiable, unlike the saw, in a Gladstone bag at London's Waterloo Station. A few days later, he called back to get it out. Doesn't matter why, the police were then mounting watch. They stopped him.
We're detective officers. Does that bag belong to you?
Yes, it does.
Can I see what's in it?
Haven't got the key on me.
Then I'm afraid you'll have to come with us.
Rubbish,
said Mahan, sheer bravado. Come along.
He went along many corridors that have led him here, to Lewis. Castles pauses, deliberately, before his final question. Did you desire the death of Miss Kay?
Never, never, never.
You might almost think those words were a signal to the elements. No sooner are they spoken than there's a violent flash of lightning and an appalling crash of thunder. A storm's been brewing over Lewis all this afternoon, but to break at this particular moment, it's remarkable. And no less remarkable is the accused's reaction. Quite a lot of people are on edge in thunderstorms, but rarely to the same extent as Mahan. Mahan now. His mouth twitches, his hands tremble. He shrinks back in the box as a man might do under gunfire. There is a possible explanation that the jury do not know. That Mahan doesn't give. That never came out at the trial. By strange coincidence, a thunderstorm had been brewing when Mahan, doing his grisly work at the bungalow, was dealing with the most grisly job of all. The head, the woman's head. He had severed it from the trunk. Built a huge fire in the sitting room. Placed her head upon it. Then, I owe a debt here to Edgar Wallace, who edited the transcript of the Mahan trial. Then the storm broke with a violent flash of lightning and an appalling crash of thunder. As the head of Emily Kay lay upon the coals, the dead eyes opened, and Mahan fled out to the deserted shore. When he nerved himself to return, the fire had done its work. I was quoting Edgar Wallace. I might add, it confirms Wallace, the head was never found. Scents and sounds can recall people and events as vividly, sometimes more than places can or pictures. That thunderclap doesn't put Mahan in the best of shape to face Curtis Bennett's cross-examination. Curtis Bennett begins by stressing Mahan's easy morals.
Did you have connection with Miss Kay the first time you went out?
Old-fashioned connection. Before four-letter words were commonplace. But whatever you call it, no odds, it means the same.
Connection the first time you went out?
Yes, says Mahan. Yes, that is so.
Did you have connection with her on other occasions?
Yes.
Were you fond of Miss Kay?
I liked her.
Were you fond of her?
Mahon reflects.
Yes, I was fond of her.
Still fond of her in March?
Mahon backpedals a little.
I liked her tremendously.
Still having connection with her?
Yes.
I want to understand what your case is,
says Curtis Bennett. Ominous phrase from counsel of his caliber.
Is it your case that you were being seduced by this lady?
Yes.
It was becoming repugnant to you and you wanted to stop it.
Yes, I wanted, though, to keep friends with Miss Kay.
You mean you wanted to go on having connection with her?
I would have been content to remain intellectual friends.
Unhappy word, a most unhappy word.
Intellectual? You had never been intellectual friends.
Well, you told me that the first time you went out, you had connection.
Yes.
Preliminaries, these are preliminaries, only a prelude to the big stuff. And there are more preliminaries. Questions about money. Money given from time to time to Mahon by Miss Kay. Mahon says they were the profits of a speculation in francs. A speculation where she and he had gone in 50-50. He'd handed it over, he says, his share of the stake. Handed it over, £125, at the outset. Then he left the buying and any selling to her. Curtis Bennett isn't accepting this without some probing. He doesn't say so in so many words, but it's easy enough to infer what he suspects. That Mahon was simply plundering the woman, as long as she had savings left to plunder.
Did you take sufficient interest in the deal, if it ever took place, to find out what price francs were at that time?
Yes.
What price were they?
I can't remember exactly.
Approximately?
90 to the pound.
Did you ever notice whether you were winning or losing by this deal?
No, I left it entirely to Miss Kay.
You are a businessman,
says Curtis Bennett.
Yes. Did you ever ask her the price she'd bought at?
No.
Bought at with your money. You didn't ask her.
No.
Curtis Bennett registers incredulity. Maybe the jury also feel incredulous. But these are still preliminaries. Preliminaries to the crux. When did Mahon buy the knife and saw? He's already told the jury on 12th April, before he went to Eastbourne.
When did you make up your mind to say you'd bought them on 12th April?
I don't follow, Mahon says.
Don't you? At the police court hearing, were there four witnesses from the Kitchen Equipment Company?
Yes.
Who said you bought them on 12th April?
Yes.
You heard their evidence?
Yes.
They produced invoices?
Yes.
Was it then you decided to say you had bought them on 12th April?
Mahon searching for escape, but the net is closing.
Up till then, you had been telling the police you'd bought them on the 17th. The 17th of April, hadn't you? Yes. It's in a statement that you read and signed. Yes, I know, but there were mistakes in that statement about the dates. I was in mental agony. It's a clear statement, isn't it, that you'd bought the knife and saw after the death of Miss Kay? Yes? To dispose of her body? Yes, on the face of it, yes it is. But in fact, you went down to Eastbourne on 12th April. 12th April. With a chef's knife and a saw.
Mahon is not a fool. He agrees. He can't disagree. But he agrees with obvious dread. Dread of where this is taking him. Dread of what awaits him.
You told Mr. Cassels, didn't you, that on Tuesday 15th April, before the London visit, before the resulting quarrel, you'd made up your mind to tell your wife all about Miss Kay?
Yes.
Tell her the next day?
Yes.
So you'd no need to be afraid of your wife finding out.
Finding out, says Mahon.
Yes. Finding out you'd been with Miss Kay at the bungalow. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Why then didn't you communicate with somebody at once when you saw that Miss Kay had received those injuries?
Mahon rocks as if trying to stir his brains.
It's an easy question to ask, he says.
I want to know the answer.
I lost my head, that's all.
Oh, says Curtis Bennett. You lost your head. And having lost your head, you left the lady's body in the bungalow. Is that right?
Yes.
Next day, moved it into the spare room.
Yes.
And the same day, on the Wednesday, went up to London.
Yes.
To keep your appointment with Miss Duncan.
Ah, yes, yes, Miss Duncan. Mahon had picked her up in London a couple of nights before he joined Emily Kay in Eastbourne. Then next week he took Miss Duncan back to the bungalow. Slept with her there, on the bed where he'd slept with Emily Kay. Slept with her while Emily Kay's cold and broken body lay in the spare room behind a fastened door. The jury weren't out long, 3/4 of an hour. They found Mahon guilty, properly and rightly, no doubt of it whatever, on the relevant evidence. But I have an idea that what absolutely sealed his fate wasn't strictly relevant at all. It was the cutting up. The cutting up, bit by bit, of that woman's body. A body which he had fondled, which he had embraced, which he had kissed. Not proof, dismemberment, not the slightest proof of murder. Might result from panic, might result from folly. But underscored here by the Duncan episode, it has a pulverizing effect on ordinary beings. If he would do that, they think, he would do anything. I'm sure that Mahon would, that he did murder Emily Kay. I'm sustained in that belief by the fact that he confessed. Not in court, at the last minute. When his appeal had been dismissed, when his hope of reprieve had gone, when there was no longer any point in holding out, Mahon confessed.